Well, hello and welcome to the Smells Like Money podcast. Join me, Suzanne Chin Taylor, the doo-doo diva, as I interview guests who are making an impact on how we manage and operate systems for conveying and treating wastewater. As a veteran of the wastewater, trenchless, and civil infrastructure industry, each week I'll be bringing you industry know-how from industry pros who know how. Join me each week as I speak with representatives of organizations that are utilizing disruptive or new technologies and methods, and executives who are excited to share how to be successful and sustainable in our vital industry. So whether you want to learn about the latest trends in technology, in treatment or trenchless, gain tips on training and retaining great talent, or simply how to be more efficient, productive, or profitable, this podcast is for you. Ready? Let's dive right in. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Doo-Doo Divas Smells Like Money podcast. Today, we are visiting with Sean Karachsky, and he is the president and CEO of CIP. Now, not to be confused with CIPP, although there is some tie in here about how those two could work together. And so with that, welcome to the show, Sean.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. We're going to be talking today about money and funding and everything related to this, because as we think about aging infrastructure, one of the biggest issues is how do we get the funds to take care of this? How do we find the means to upgrade our plants, to take care of underground infrastructure, to try new things? You know, where do we get these funds without, I would say, burdening our ratepayers or having to raise taxes and all those things? And so I want Sean to explain what the name of his company, CIP, stands for. And then we'll start diving into things about the infrastructure bill, state revolving funds, and all those means and what it takes to get your share of the pie to get the things done that you want to get done for your community. So great. Sean, yeah. Thanks. Tell us about you.
Yeah, sure. So CIP stands for Community Infrastructure Partners. This was a company that started in August of 2022. And we are practitioners of a delivery model that was created by the EPA called the Community-Based Public-Private Partnership. So a lot of people are obviously familiar with standard P3s, public-private partnerships, a contract between the public side and the private side to deliver an asset of some sort, financing usually a very key component of that, as well as risk transference. The interesting part of a CBP3 is where there's less focus on the financing side. And obviously with this being about money, we'll get into why that is, but more focused on incorporating community-based benefits into the desired outcomes of the infrastructure delivery.
So that's the big difference, is that it's more about the community and less about the finances between these two.
Yeah, it's a big difference, I will say. And the way we like to think about it is a lot of the communities that that really are struggling the most from an infrastructure perspective are the most vulnerable, disenfranchised, underfunded. And so if you're going to make these types of investments in those communities to improve their infrastructure, how can you do it with a focus on community-based benefits and almost like economic development for those communities, using the people within the communities to solve the problems within their community?
Oh, I like that. Oh, that's great. So, you know, before we came on the show, we were talking about, you know, the big infrastructure bill, and you had shared some interesting little things as it relates to, you know, water, wastewater, infrastructure. And, you know, we both agreed, like you were saying, disenfranchised, and the ones that need it the most are struggling to get their share of the pie because they have to go through these elaborate, often long drawn out application processes. And they they most likely do not have the infrastructure or the personnel and the resources to take care of that paperwork. And so, how do you see an organization like yours would help those underserved communities or those ones that they just can't do it. They need it, but they just simply can't take that burden on.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem, Suzanne. I think what we've been seeing is as aging infrastructure continues to age without getting improvements and funding and fixes, the problems that the municipalities and utilities have been dealing with historically are growing, but their staffs aren't growing because of long-term pension obligations and other municipal budgets, utility budgets. So you have a group that needs to do more with less, mm-hmm. and then you marry that to very complicated and onerous grant and funding application processes. So what we try to do is we really offer what we would say would be a soup to nuts solution, where we will help them actually fill out those applications for funding. They'll still be the borrower, obviously, and the signer of that. But just because we have the ability and the familiarity with doing that, we could do it more efficiently. And really, that's the first key to all of this: is how do you even figure out how to get whatever funding is available to you to address some of these problems?
Right, and you had mentioned to me about that the borrowing power, that some of the monies that are available for these entities, it's cheap money.
It's very, very cheap money. Yeah. So we're doing a lot of work currently around the lead service line issue. So there's $15 billion in the infrastructure bill getting distributed from the federal government into the individual states, each state having its own specific rules around rates and otherwise. Louisiana, for example, is 0% interest over 30 years. Wisconsin is 0.25% interest, and it varies by state. But that's about as cheap money as you can get, and it's cheaper than the traditional drinking water SRFs right now. So they're trying as hard as they can to make it as affordable for a lot of these communities to take advantage and address these issues.
So you work in, obviously, you know, those lead lines like water, but you've also done some incredible work with stormwater, and this can apply to any type of infrastructure project, wastewater as well, correct?
Yeah, there's a few components that I think are required to make the model worthwhile. So typically we think about it as the ability to take things that would historically be done as individual projects and bring them all together and manage them as a program. So if you think about a traditional procurement process that a public entity might go through, they may need to procure for 20, 30, 50 individual small to medium sized projects that is so resource intensive, not only to put the bidding packages out, but to manage that process and then to manage each individual project from within that. So historically, that's really been the traditional way that work has been done. A CBP3 puts all that into a programmatic delivery. And so by doing that, you get economies of scale to drive down costs and drive out a lot of the inefficiencies. So the idea really is better, faster, cheaper, with all these community-based benefits and risk transference that also obviously is a key component of a traditional P3.
I love how you're saying put that into a program. So how exactly does that work where they do that? How does that affect, you know, budgets and management and all that, you know, this is really coming at it from a totally different approach than what they're used to, which may be a little scary for some folks. Like, how do we know that everything, you know, we know it's a risk averse, you know, we're dealing with people's health, we're dealing with water, we're dealing with sanitation. So there's a lot of risk involved. And so people are like, oh boy, I don't know about this. And so when you said removing the risk, what exactly did you mean by that? Because I know that's a big, dirty word.
Yeah, so risk takes on a lot of different elements as it pertains to this. So I think just going back to your original observation, which is spot on, is you know, I came from a management consulting world where the mantra was always nobody got fired for hiring IBM, right? Which meant they were more expensive. You know, we're going back many years, but in the old world of IBM, and it was safe so that if something failed, you just said, I hired the best there was, what how could you blame me or hold me accountable for that? So I think when we think about that in the world of public procurement, this is so different from the way that people traditionally procure for these projects. It's really two things. One is it's an education and it's a knowledge piece, but also it does seem risky and new and different and dangerous, and they don't have the means, the methods, the experience. So there's a lot of procurement. There's a lot of legal. Can we even do this? Do we have the legislation? Is it design build? Is it program management? What is it? And, you know, as you get into the place where you can't fit it into a box, you oftentimes get spun up and things really stall there. So it's really important that we spend a lot of time on education and getting people to understand, yes, you can do this. Yes, this is precedent. Here's how. So that's one side of it. But to your other question about risk, we really do spend a lot of time trying to convince all stakeholders and less convince than really educate about what it does mean to transfer the risk to the private side. So typically municipalities and utilities are on the hook for cost overruns. You know, they don't have necessarily set pricing or timelines or things of that nature. And in a CBP3, you're really developing those types of performance measures that are tied to private sector compensation. So if we say there's a fixed price, you know, per lead service line of X dollars, if it's X plus, that's on the private side. So it gives not only budget certainty and planning certainty, but it gives financial certainty as well.
So when you were saying about bundling, just can you give me an example? I guess what's going through my mind, so say you have a city that they know that they need to reline a certain number of lines, main lines within a basin, and they need to rehabilitate the manholes, or they want to do some other INI or some flow metering. Are you saying that for something like that, you would make it all one package? But I guess what I was trying to understand, can it be extended over years, or does it have to be done within a certain time frame?
Yeah, all those things are available options, really.
Okay.
So I'll give you a couple of flavors. So one could be, community X in the Pacific coast somewhere,
right,
has stormwater management issues. And they say we have, X dollars to put towards stormwater management projects, retrofits, new infrastructure, all that. And so the idea would be, instead of them coming to the table saying, we want to build this there and we want to build this one over there, what we would work with them to do is say, what are the goals of what you're trying to accomplish in your community with the dollars you have available? Don't tell us or pen us into specific projects. You give us the criteria and we'll find those projects for you within your footprint. And then bring those back to you where you have governance over what gets built, when it gets built, prioritization, all those things. But it allows more of an open market, if you will, that we could then bring designers, engineers, construction, other sort of participants into the program where they're almost sourcing those projects for you within the program, understanding that if they find good projects, those are going to get built. So if you extrapolate that, all of a sudden, then the public side is pushing the onus onto the private side to find those projects for them. But within the programmatic construct, as we said earlier, then all of a sudden you start to get efficiencies because you have more competition to find projects, to build those projects. It's not just one-off sort of design build. It's all within that programmatic structure.
And it also sounds like with a program like that, you're kind of removing that low bid scenario where we're going to put the specs out and that we're going to choose a solution or a vendor based on quality, quality and capability versus purely on price.
Correct. Yeah. And we believe you know, our opinion is low bid is a fallacy still, and it's lazy to a degree in that people are burdened with that. And so I don't think there's any question that more times than not, you're sacrificing quality for cost and accountability and all the things that go with that. So I think the lead, again, is a pretty good example where I know the mayor of Ann Arbor, as an example, changed their ordinance in that city to be able to go on best value versus low bid. And all of the, there's so many other things that go into defining value, and cost is just one dimensional. And you could make an argument for cost if cost stayed. But I think, as you know, from your experience as well, you get in on cost, and then all of a sudden, after you're selected, the cost that you started with isn't necessarily the cost you ended up with. So what's the point of that in the first place?
And also looking at not just the cost for the immediate project, but in a program and like something long, like you're saying, what is going to be the total cost for the ownership for the life of whatever it is that you've selected?
Absolutely.
What are you going to have? What is it going to cost you 10 years from now?
Yeah. And to your point, incorporating the thought process today about that longer term operations and maintenance, because if you're not thinking about that, you're just starting over and punting the problem 10, 15, 20 years down the road, right? That's how, it's not really a secret of how we've ended up where we have as a country in the first place, which is unfunded, you know, deferred maintenance.
I like the way that you put that. You're right. Unfunded deferred, but it's a really good way of putting it. So circling back around to that topic of money, is there truly, like under these bills, is there truly money to be had? And how hard is it to get that share of the pie? And if somebody works with you, yeah, it's like, how much easier are you going to make it? Because there are people that truly need their share of the pie. And what is it going to, I guess maybe listeners are going to be like, yeah, I know that money's out there, but what is it really going to take, Sean, for me to get that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's a complicated question driven by, I think, there's been so much news and press out there about bipartisan infrastructure law. Right. And so I think we're starting to see movement and momentum around some of that funding. And again, we're really dealing in kind of a pretty narrow swath of that. But I think what we're seeing holds up across, you know, the other components of the infrastructure, which is communities understanding what the requirements are for that particular funding. What is principal forgiveness? What do they have to take out in loans? Understanding those dynamics within each state, as we said, has their own rules around that. But I think it is a bit of a cumbersome process. It is just by nature. And I think it's driven by the fact that they want to make sure that that money is spent as equitably as possible and is going to the communities that need it most. So it's an absolutely admirable mission and end objective. It's then, how do you put the processes in place that enable that to happen? And unfortunately, it can't to do that. So we really are doing a lot of work within the state revolving funds to understand what their processes are. And then there's a couple things off of that. So as you said earlier, we're working directly with communities to actually fill out applications alongside of them on their behalf. And then there's another piece that I think is a really important topic around this whole idea, which is regionalization. So there are so many smaller and rural communities, water utilities that are resource starved beyond our wildest comprehension. And so where you have federal agencies that are doing as much outreach and technical assistance as they can, the number of communities that meet those designations are far greater than the resources that are available to them to actually help. So what we're trying to do, and we've had some early success, is to use larger municipalities or utilities to serve as what we would call a regional hub, where you actually set up your program using them as the center point, but you can go, whether it's multi-county outside, concentric circle, however you define, you know, the outer rings of where you're starting from, to reach out to as many of those, communities, and to see if they want to participate in the program that is already being set up. So they would still apply for funding. We would still help them, but then they don't have to figure out, well, how are we going to do the delivery and where are we going to find the contractors and how do we make sure that we don't get gouged on pricing because we only have, you know, one project or 40 lines or whatever it is to get people out here. How do we maybe then be able to incorporate our own socioeconomic needs? So maybe you're in a tribal community attaching to a community that's predominantly Latino, and how do we bring in your small businesses into this program as well? So it's a long-winded way, Suzanne, of saying the opportunity is there to be able to create those regional hubs and actually use the mechanism that's put in place to operationally deliver in surrounding communities.
That's a fantastic concept. Fantastic concept. So Sean, I'm sure, you know, this could go on and on and go really into the weeds. And so for those who are listening, how can they learn more about this topic, maybe the potential or the opportunity to work with you, again, getting back to helping them get their share of the pie? What's the best way to do that?
Sure. There's a couple things. So one is, I think just for pure education, I would point them to a couple places. So one, on the EPA's own website, they have white papers and information around community-based public-private partnerships, just general education around what that is. On our website, which is communityinfrastructurepartners.com. It's a mouthful. I won't spell it, but I'm sure everybody can figure that out. There's a lot of resources out there, including we have just a really quick 2-minute sort of for the older people like me that remember Schoolhouse Rock, like a Schoolhouse Rock, no music, but type video that explains a CBP3. And so there's also resources about procurements that have been issued for CBP3s before. So there's a lot of different sources of information, and obviously anybody could always reach out to me directly. I'm on both LinkedIn and through the website, you know, Sean, S-H-A-W-N at yourcip.com. We're constantly in education and just sharing this concept because we believe it really is the right delivery model for a lot of communities around the country.
Well, thank you, Sean. And I agree. This is a great opportunity for anybody listening that is, you know, responsible for managing their infrastructure, looking for solutions, feels like they're up against it, and is looking for help, that this is a great resource. And so definitely reach out to Sean. And again, thank you for being on the show. And to you out there listening, thank you for tuning in. And until next time, keep it flowing. Thanks so much for joining me, the Doo-Doo Diva, on this week's episode of Smells Like Money. What stood out to you this week? Share your takeaways by leaving me a review. You can find out more about the new technologies, creating sustainable solutions and insights on how to succeed in our vital industry by subscribing to the show. Whether you want to learn about the latest trends in wastewater infrastructure, treatment, or trenchless, you've got it all right here at Smells Like Money. If you're an industry expert and would like to be considered as a guest for the show, book a quick chat with me by visiting calendly.com/thetuitgroup/B-A-podcast-guest, or simply click the link in the show notes below. Until next week, a big shout out to all my industry friends and those who will be. You are my superheroes. Thanks for tuning in, keeping it flowing, and we'll see you all next week.